1 month ago, I spoke about some of the problems that have led to the crisis in the auto industry and about what would be required to ensure that General Motors and Chrysler emerge from their current troubles stronger and more competitive. My team will continue working with General Motors as they strengthen their business plan and move towards restructuring that's consistent with the principles that I've laid out. And today, after consulting with my auto task force, I can report that the necessary steps have been taken to give one of America's most storied automakers, Chrysler, a new lease on life. This is a company that has a particular claim on our American identity. It's a company founded in the early years of the American automobile industry, a company that helped make the 20th century an American century, and that came to embody, along with the two other members of the Big Three, the ingenuity, the industriousness, and the indomitable spirit of the American people. Chrysler has not only been an icon of America's auto industry and a source of pride for generations of American workers, it's been responsible for helping build our middle class, giving countless Americans the chance to provide for their families, sending their kids to college, saving for a secure retirement. It's what hundreds of thousands of auto workers and suppliers and dealers and their families rely on to pay their bills in communities across our industrial Midwest and across the country. It's been a pillar of our industrial economy, but frankly a pillar that's been weakened by papering over tough problems and avoiding hard choices. For too long, Chrysler moved too slowly to adapt to the future, designing and building cars that were less popular, less reliable, and less fuel efficient than foreign competitors. That's part of what has brought us to a point where they sought taxpayer assistance. But, as I've said from the start, we simply cannot keep this company or any company afloat on an endless supply of tax dollars. My job as president is to ensure that if tax dollars are being put on the line, they are being invested in a real fix that will make Chrysler more competitive. That's why I rejected the original restructuring plan that Chrysler offered last month. It was clear that if we put tax dollars in that plan, it would be a bad deal for American taxpayers and would not put the company on a viable path. But it's also clear that if Chrysler was able to form a partnership with the international car company Fiat, there was a chance Chrysler could have a bright future. After consulting with my auto task force, industry experts, and financial advisors, I decided to give Chrysler and Fiat 30 days to reach an agreement. The standard I set was high. I challenged them to design a plan that would protect American jobs, American taxpayers, and the future of a great American car company. But over the past months, seemingly insurmountable obstacles have been overcome. And Chrysler's most important stakeholders, from the United Auto Workers to Chrysler's largest lenders, from its former owners to its suppliers, have agreed to make major sacrifices. So, today, I am pleased to announce that Chrysler and Fiat have formed a partnership that has a strong chance of success. It's a partnership that will save more than 30,000 jobs at Chrysler and tens of thousands of jobs at suppliers, dealers, and other businesses that rely on this company. It's a partnership that the federal government will support by making additional loans that are consistent with what I outlined last month. As part of their agreement, every dime of new taxpayer money will be repaid before Fiat can take a majority ownership stake in Chrysler. In addition, considering Chrysler's extensive operations in Canada, the government of Canada is also committing resources to ensure that Chrysler has a chance to succeed, and we're working closely with them. It's a partnership that will give Chrysler a chance not only to survive, but to thrive in a global auto industry. Fiat has demonstrated that it can build the clean, fuel-efficient cars that are the future of the industry. And as part of this agreement, Fiat has already agreed to transfer billions of dollars in cutting-edge technology to Chrysler to help them do the same. Fiat's also committed to working with Chrysler to build new fuel-efficient cars and engines right here in America. Now, this partnership was only possible because of unprecedented sacrifices on the part of Chrysler's stakeholders who are willing to give something up so that this company and all the men and women whose livelihoods depend on it might see a better day. Chrysler's management, and in particular its CEO, Robert Nardelli, have played a positive and constructive role throughout this process. The United Auto Workers, who had already made painful concessions, agreed to further cuts in wages and benefits, cuts that will help Chrysler survive, making it possible for so many workers to keep their jobs and about 170,000 retirees and their families to keep their health care. Several major financial institutions, led by J.P. Morgan, agreed to reduce their debt to less than one-third of its face value to help free Chrysler from its crushing obligations. The German automaker, Daimler, agreed to give up its stake in Chrysler and contribute to the company's pension plan, further easing Chrysler's financial burden. And countless Americans across our country will be making major sacrifices as well as a result of plans to consolidate dealers, brands, and product lines. And while many stakeholders made sacrifices and worked constructively, I have to tell you some did not. In particular, a group of investment firms and hedge funds decided to hold out for the prospect of an unjustified taxpayer-funded bailout. They were hoping that everybody else would make sacrifices and they would have to make none. Some demanded twice the return that other lenders were getting. I don't stand with them. I stand with Chrysler's employees and their families and communities. I stand with Chrysler's management, its dealers, and its suppliers. I stand with the millions of Americans who own and want to buy Chrysler cars. I don't stand with those who held out when everybody else is making sacrifices. That's why I'm supporting Chrysler's plans to use our bankruptcy laws to clear away its remaining obligations so the company can get back on its feet and onto a path of success. Now, no one should be confused about what a bankruptcy process means. This is not a sign of weakness, but rather one more step on a clearly charted path to Chrysler's revival. Because of the fact that the UAW and many of the banks, the biggest stakeholders in this whole process, have already aligned, have already agreed, this process will be quick. It will be efficient. It's designed to deal with those last few holdups, and it will be controlled. It will not disrupt the lives of the people who work at Chrysler or live in communities that depend on it. And it will not affect the ability of American consumers to buy a Chrysler or to get it serviced and repaired. It's a process that has the full support of Chrysler's key stakeholders and the full backing of the United States government. And I have every confidence that Chrysler will emerge from this process stronger and more competitive.
Okay, there you have it. The President of the United States today announcing that Chrysler will enter into Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Wanted you to hear that whole thing. Everyone seemed to be on board, with the exception of some hedge funds who were holding out for a better deal, who would rather liquidate a company and get more money for their bonds than they would participate in the reorganization of a company, of an industry, and of a country. The president seeming very optimistic that somehow this would be quick and efficient, in his words, with the support of even those big banks who at the last minute came to the table, which I will tell you why that is. And I'm going to tell you who is holding out, why this company has been forced into bankruptcy, and what that means. Clearly, a tough day for all of those in Detroit as I drove to this show in a rainy construction zone with Chryslers in front of me, behind me, and actually me in one. A lot of people wondering just how quick and efficient this will be for everybody. So we're going to be all over this, obviously, today. Big news here in Detroit, although the media coverage continued to obsess about the swine flu. It's the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. There you have it. You got what you wanted, folks. According to polls, a bankrupt auto industry. Are you happy about that? 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 1-888-646-2629 as we cover the Category 5 earthquake. On the Nancy Stephen Show, 1-888-NANCY, or 64-NANCY, that's 1-646-2629, on this pretty bleak day here in Detroit, with the news of the forced Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing in New York under Section 363B of Chapter 11. A lot of numbers meaning not much. We're going to try and sort all this out with you. Joining me to talk about these developments is Mark Phelan, who's the best auto critic at the Detroit Free Press, who happens to be in New Orleans trying to have a vacation, but unsuccessful in that because his expertise is needed on this day. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Nancy. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, sorry about your vacation getting wiped out.
Hey, when history happens, you stop and pay attention.
Yeah, I know. I should be in Cabo myself, and I'm not in Mexico, so here we go. We're both in the same boat.
Sorry.
Okay, so, you know, here's the disconnect. I just watched that we're going to have some sound from the press conference with the Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, about this and the sort of the behind-the-scenes questioning. There's kind of two stories going on here, is there not, Mark? The president seemed all but hopeful, cheery. Everyone's come together, and in the end, it was the UAW who made massive concessions. Fiat came to the table. Even the big banks came to the table, took their haircut. How on earth could some small holdouts, hedge funds, these people that the president said he did not stand with, how on earth could they have the power to force this thing into bankruptcy?
Well, it's sort of amazing. I mean, they do have the legal standing to say, we're bondholders, we don't like this deal, we're not going to take it. But where they think that they're going to end up with a better package than the 30 or 32 cents on the dollar that they were going to get if they had accepted the deal is a mystery to most people at this point. If you go into bankruptcy, you know, you are at the court's mercy, and the president made it pretty clear that he thinks that the court will be sympathetic to all of the other stakeholders, the UAW, the workers, the major bondholders who have given a lot of concessions, and you know he doesn't expect the judge to you know, be all that friendly toward the people who threw a wrench into the works.
But the fate of all of these interests rests in the hand of a bankruptcy judge somewhere in New York, right? And we don't know who that person is.
We don't know who it is. I've spoken to a few bankruptcy attorneys, and one thing that they've all agreed on is that it doesn't make that much difference where the actual bankruptcy was filed. You know, there have been some people saying Detroit would be better for the UAW or for the automakers, but there seems to be a consensus that the judge will, wherever it takes place, the judge will try the fact and the law and won't be all that swayed by the local considerations.
Hmm. Now, so Bob Nardelli has stepped down as Chrysler CEO. Was that a condition of the task force in the deal, or is he just out of there? We don't know that.
My understanding, and this may have changed in the last couple of minutes because things are, but my understanding is that he will step down as soon as Chrysler clears bankruptcy. And that is, part of the deal that Fiat had been talking about all along.
Yep.
That when they are providing the technology and platforms for the new fuel-efficient little cars, Fiat and the government will talk together about who will be the board of directors of the new company. Nardelli will leave, and someone probably from Fiat will be the chairman, and someone from the American side of Chrysler will be the CEO of the new company.
Yeah. Now, there's an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today saying it should be called Gettelfinger Motors, that essentially the UAW has wrested control and come out smelling like a rose. Yeah, right. This was great for the fact that they had to give up half of their essentially half of their obligations to a health care fund and take some equity. Doesn't seem to me like they didn't get their haircut. What do you think, Mark?
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that over the next couple of years, there will inevitably be a couple more Chrysler factories that close because they just have the capacity to build more cars than they can, you know, conceivably need. So the union's not getting out of this without taking you know, its share of pain.
Right. And one board, and regardless, one board seat nonetheless, even if they are, they're just getting their what was due them in terms of equity. They're just getting one board seat and getting hope. Equity is hope that this company survives. That's all anyone has. All right.
That's
Mark,
a perfect way to play.
You're going to hang with us, will you, for a little bit? We've got a few more questions
here.
Right. Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press stays with us. 1-888-64 Nancy, as we try to digest exactly what this means on the Nancy Skinner Show. Okay, so we got like a really big game of chicken that went really bad, essentially. If you want me to sum it up euphemistically, that's what we're looking at. Let's try to get some guts on this. And then Nancy's going to show 1-888-64 Nancy, the number to the program. I'm with Mark Phelan, the auto reporter from the Detroit Free Press. So, Mark, as I'm looking at the situation in terms of the bankruptcy, it seems to be like this is where it is. And we talked just a little earlier today about this, that in the bankruptcy court, the junk bondholders are the ones who really held out. That, you know, they bought a discounted debt. And even though the big banks came in, it was the junk bondholders who, I'm going to talk about one of them in the Wall Street Journal, this guy who's having a hard time. Oh, it was such a tough decision for him because he's still mad about his dad's situation when they the pension which airline that went into bankruptcy, one of the airline, Delta Airlines. So he's so mad about that he wants to punish all of the auto workers as a result. He was one of those junk bondholders. I kid you not. We're going to talk about this guy. His name is Jeffrey Gwynn of Group G Capital Partners. But Jeff Gwynn and others with consternation held out because they are saying they have the first lien secured collateral, and they'll get 65 cents on the dollar versus the offer that was 33 cents on the dollar. And you would think that under bankruptcy law, everyone and the president said, well, we've got the banks, we've got the UAW, we've got everyone on board, but they don't have the numbers of creditors that they need to make it easy, you know, rubber stamp this thing through free and clear. So they're going to try and have to divide this up into two companies, the good company, the bad company. You know, this is anything but surgical, quick, and efficient, as I look at these details.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, a big part of what makes, you know, the bankruptcy process scary. Because once you go into it, it's out of your control. There's a judge who has to follow the law. And everybody thinks the law is on their side when they go into court, and somebody's always wrong. It still mystifies me a little bit that those bondholders could be that certain that they will get a better deal and that they're that much smarter than J.P. Morgan and the big banks that said, no, this offer from the Treasury is good enough for us, we'll take it. But they were convinced, you know, who knows? You know, maybe, you know, there are some of those lovely credit default swaps still out there, so they felt like they won either way. But
correct, right. So that's their calculation. They think that they have the first lien, and according to what I'm reading, they do. So, you know, of course, a judge has at the end of this whole thing on this primer on bankruptcy says that the judge's bankruptcy judges do have wide latitude, but that could go either way. You know, I mean, if they say, listen, you know, we have the right to this collateral, and we have the first lien, then we get the assets, and the government's saying, well, we could sell that. There's a provision where we could sell it. Instead of just handing you, say, all the assets, we could sell them free and clear of encumbrances. That's another provision of the code. So the judge has to choose which provision prevails.
And there's a real question, who is going to pay how much money for any of Chrysler's assets? I mean, if car companies were valuable assets, you know, right now, we wouldn't be going through this. Chrysler is losing money. What assets do they have that these guys can hope to recoup their investment from? It's very difficult to figure out what the calculus was that went into their turning down the offer.
Tell me about, I know you don't have much time, so tell me about the other things going on around this, because as we've talked about, Mark, a lot on the program, this is not just about Chrysler. There are suppliers who are teetering. How does this start to affect anyone else? Is everyone just going to take a deep breath and keep their cool until we figure out who the judge is, or are suppliers freaking, or is GM? This obviously is sending a message to the GM bondholders, is it not?
Definitely. And the first thing is that the government has okayed assistance to the key suppliers that were in the most danger. So there doesn't seem to be any immediate likelihood of a sort of a domino effect that takes down the whole industry. And Chrysler should be able to continue operations more or less as normal, at least while this thing is in court. And maybe they'll get lucky and they will get the 30 to 60 day exit from bankruptcy that the president's talking about. But you're right about GM. One of the theories has been that when the task force said neither of these viability plans work, Chrysler, you got 30 days to come up with a good one. GM, you got 60 days. But part of what they were thinking was a Chrysler bankruptcy could be manageable. A GM one would be a disaster. So if Chrysler gets a deal, that forms the template for a deal at GM. If Chrysler doesn't get a deal, the government can go to the bondholders and say, you think we were kidding here? We're serious. We will pull the trigger on bankruptcy. And then it becomes a real crapshoot.
So is that perhaps why Chrysler only got 30 days and GM got 60?
Nobody knows for sure, but that's a theory that makes as much sense as any others that are out there.
I watched a White House press briefing, and Robert Gibbs was taking questions from this was Garrett, Major Garrett from Fox News, saying, well, why don't those bondholders have every right that everyone else did? Why should the U.S. government be forcing or changing laws? And why, if these guys have the right to it, why shouldn't their day in court be exercised? Is this going to turn into a big fight over what's right for the country versus contractual obligations of first lien holders of junk bond status, honestly?
Well, it appears to be, and that was part of the point that the president was making when he said that the UAW and the big bondholders came to the table and did what was good for them and best for the country, and some of the other bondholders declined to do that and held out for what he described more or less as their own narrow self-interest. It'll be a question of who wins in court and who seems more sympathetic in the public eye, the people who gave so that everybody got something or those who held out.
It just seems to me that the government would have a lot more recourse in this instance since they have been such a player and they have so much skin in the game, as they were with banks. They've been able to limit executive compensation, do so much in terms of the banks. Why do they have no power over these bondholders, to whom they've loaned this amount of money? Because it was a loan, essentially, that they are just another loan, a loan holder, just like they're in the same line?
I think that's part of it, and part of it is that the banks that have accepted federal assistance are more beholden to the government. These other bondholders perhaps have not, and they don't feel like they have to listen when the government says this is what we think is the best course.
Well, we shall see. The game of chicken just got a way lot scarier than the swine flu, to put it that way. Yesterday spent the whole day going, oh, my God, there's so much hysteria worldwide about a couple runny noses. I know there's been 150 deaths. There's 36,000 every year from the flu. And we're on the brink of collapse. There's barely a mention of this bankruptcy till, oh, yeah, it happened. So,
and we've got a month on the countdown until we know what happens with GM as well. So yeah, we'll be keeping busy.
Another month, you bet. Well, hey, listen, go have one of those hurricanes for me while you're down there, because I didn't get my margaritas down in Mexico. So do your work for me and then get back here.
Thank you, Nancy.
Mark Thielen from the Detroit Free Press. Thanks so much for joining me. All right, there you have it. I mean, I'm trying to explain this. I know it's very confusing. You would see the press conference and think, wow, this is good, and it's going to end up just like surgical bankruptcy, and certainly the president was very, you know, he was peeved at these guys. He said, we'll play that again. I do not stand with them. That everybody came to the table in good standing. And you know what? I'm going to talk about this guy. I'm reading about how torn he was about what to do. I mean, we're essentially accepting the difference between 65 cents on a dollar and 33 cents on the dollar when you bought junk bonds to begin with. And this small group of people is causing this huge, catastrophic thing. If they do, as I'm telling you, I'm looking into the bankruptcy stuff, it's not as easy as it sounds, given the rules. Or they wouldn't have done it. Come on. They really wouldn't have done it if they didn't think that they had a 50-50 shot of coming out. And you've got a whole state on the brink. And I know we're measuring on CNN, like, how runny was their nose? Somebody 13 days ago was in Mexico when the president was there 13 days ago. And, like, how much snot's coming out of his nose? Honestly, this is ridiculous to me to watch this wall-to-wall flu coverage. When people's lives are going, their pensions, their health care, everything. And it's going to have this ripple effect going through. And everybody is obsessed with swine flu. So just a side note. And lots of people probably are happy. You got what you wanted. We want to see a bankrupt auto industry? I got a poll here about what liberals drive. They'll like that. 1-888-64-NANCY.
From the heavens, it was easy to tell. It was love from above that could save me from hell. She had fire in her soul, it was easy to see how the devil himself could be pulled out of me.
Vultures force Chrysler into bankruptcy. Let's give you a portrait of one on the Nancy Skinner Show. 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 646-2629. Unless we could talk about swine flu. Should we just talk about swine flu? Is that more important that we all talk about? Wow, what do we have now? 100 cases of swine flu in the United States? Oh yeah. Okay. Let's see. So, Jeffrey Gwynn, he is a Chrysler creditor, finds himself torn. Jeffrey Gwynn is wrestling with the knowledge that the retirement plans of some 80,000 Americans may rest in his hands. I am in turmoil, says Mr. Gwynn, principal of Group G Capital Partners, LLC, hedge funds in New York. He's one of the 46 secured creditors to Chrysler. Mr. Gwynn, he was debating Wednesday whether to accept about 33 cents on the dollar for his debt. Should any one of these debt holders vote against the plan, the automaker would likely be required to file for bankruptcy protection, a step that would complicate its reorganization and put at risk the pensions of existing employees and retirees. If a bankruptcy filing occurs, a majority of lenders could still block Chrysler's planned restructuring. President Obama had targeted these bondholders when he was in St. Louis yesterday. He said, are the bondholders, the lenders, the money people, are they willing to make sacrifices as well? We don't know yet. That was yesterday. Today, we know. I don't know how Mr. Gwynn voted, but we know that his class of bondholders, junk bondholders, voted no. And Chrysler has filed bankruptcy. At the heart of his angst, Mr. Gwynn says, lies his own family's experience. His father, a 30-year veteran of Delta Airlines, lost most of his pension and health care benefits after the airline filed for bankruptcy protection in 2005. Julius Gwynn, now 70 years old, started his career with Ford Motor Company before joining Delta in 1967, working in its finance and corporate planning departments until he retired in 1997. While he may swallow hard and vote to help salvage parts of his company, he says his father's treatment makes him loath to pave an easy road for Chrysler. So let me get this straight. Your father got screwed by Delta's bankruptcy, lost his pension. And as a result, you think that you're going to feel better by screwing Chrysler's retirees. That's right, Mr. Bondholder, Mr. Gwynn, that somehow you'll just feel better if you can get revenge on all those hardworking 80,000 people whose retirements are in his hand. He's torn his hedge fund because 80,000 people's retirements, and because it happened to his father, he wants to do it to these people to get back at Chrysler. Is this just sick or what? I mean, I can't think of any other. The greed, this whole thing just, you know, it is emblematic of how we got to this point in our history right now, this economic meltdown. That this guy, he's torn because it happened to his dad, so he's going to screw 80,000 more people who have pensions. What are they going to do? Honest to God. And you can hear that the president's mad. He should be mad. And these people, these hedge funds, these people that we have bailed out, and I have been the first one to say that the banks, because of this systemic collapse, that we had to do what they had to do. Now, because of this loophole, apparently the banks, Chase and Citigroup and those, you know why? Oh, by the way, I saw that they came around and they helped propose a deal because I had the story yesterday. Guess what? They aren't passing their stress tests. They need more money. That's why Citi and Chase came around. Yeah, we didn't get to talk about that yesterday. But their stress tests aren't looking so good, and they need to be they're going to need a little more capital. They're going to have to raise some more capital. So they really had no choice but to do this. I'm not saying they're the heroes in any of this, and I'm sure a lot of our rattlesabering about them helped, certainly. Thank you, folks. But now it comes down to these people. Who keeps calling me? You know, it is like, I only keep it on for the calls. It's yeah, guess who? Yeah, the media. Wanting to cover this. Probably Fox News. I'm sure they want me out at 9 o'clock tonight in front of Chrysler headquarters to just talk about how terrible we feel here to see our state and industry go down the tubes. Don't know if I have it in me, tell you the truth. Let's go to Tarek in California. Hi, Tarek.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. It's great. Everything's great. I'm the industry I care about, the state is gone, and I'll be off the air shortly, so it's all good. Raining. Other than that, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm not bad, but what my comment was basically is the real war by conservatives and the Republicans, it's not on, see, they like to say workers, but it's the union itself. They don't want to see unions because to them, ever since, you know, if you go back in history, ever since unions existed, Republicans called them communists. Now they're called socialists. And I don't know what they might be called next year. They might be called terrorists. But the idea is unions have always been a threat because when workers get together, they will not accept being exploited. And these major companies, they want to exploit the workers. And when they see unions gathering, I mean, you know, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh or you listen to Bill O'Reilly, hopefully nobody listens to them, but if you just get a glimpse of them, other than the comedy you'll hear, you'll always hear them attacking unions. And the thing I don't understand is anybody with common sense, what's wrong with a bunch of workers gathering and saying we don't want to be exploited? If you can tell me, even if you speak from let's say you want to tell me the conservative point of view, I really would like to know it. What is wrong with unions? What is wrong with a bunch of workers making minimum wage saying, you know what, we're not going to be exploited and we're not going to work 60-hour weeks? And I don't understand what this war is against them. What is it that they're doing? They're not getting...
Well, first of all, Tarek, you should listen to the other side to hear what they're saying. Absolutely, because there are, you know, they've had a certain level of influence with that argument that has diminished the importance of unions, where they used to be 35% of the public or something, now down to 12% of all workers. And what has happened, Tarek, is that as a result of that loss of bargaining power, wages continue to go down, and as wages go down, people don't have enough money to buy stuff, And that's why we are in a deflationary downward spiral, because it's a race to the bottom here. And it is, in fact, the exactly what we need is increased unionization, more wages, so people can start buying these inventories. It's what we need. So you got to counter that argument head on, Tarek, head on. And so sticking your head in the sand and not listening to the other side isn't going to help, because you got to hear what they're saying to be able to counter their arguments head on. And here's where we are right now. What they don't know is the law of unintended consequences. Okay? It's also called be careful what you ask for. You just might get it. As we continue on the Nancy Skinner Show. Cover opinion. Does the U.S. need an auto industry? In their room for debate, Robert Reich and others wonder, debate, you don't really need that, right?
No.
We could get the Chinese to make our Humvees, stuff like that, right? All right, let's move along on the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY, shall we? It's a big press conference last night, the 100-day press conference of President Barack Obama. And by, I think, my account, it went very well. Let's talk to John Decker, though, because he was actually there. John Decker is the White House correspondent for Reuters TV, and he had a better seat than I did in my living room. So we'll check in with John. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Nancy. How are you?
I'm in Detroit, and I cover the auto industry and what's been going on very closely. So it's not really a great day here. A lot of people think, well, this all sounds so good. Everybody's come together. We just got to go through that quick rinse surgical bankruptcy. Not so much.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you hit the nail right on the head. Despite President Obama trying to put this in the best possible light, saying that this essentially puts a new lease on life for Chrysler, there's a lot of things that need to happen for Chrysler to have that new lease.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, what amazes me is that there's going to be, everything's going to be involved. Which judge, which bankruptcy judge, what's their ideological underpinnings? Because you could pick and choose in bankruptcy court. I just went through in my last hour the details. It was junk bond holders that held out at the very end who bought these bonds at the discount, that the big banks were essentially forced to kind of come to the plate because their stress tests aren't working out so well for them. And guess what? They need more money, John. So, of course, they're going to come to the table. But these junk bond holders think that they're going to get a better deal going through a bankruptcy court, and that they're going to get these assets and somehow sell them, okay? And there is something to go on there. So a bankruptcy judge who's predisposed to this disintegration of the company could, in fact, rule in the favor of junk bond holders. And wouldn't that be amazing, as we all are obsessed with the swine flu?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You know, they are sort of the fly in the ointment. These hedge funds were the holdouts in terms of signing on to this deal that the president was trying to put together. And, you know, from their perspective, they're interested in getting the most out of their investment. They're interested in increasing shareholder value. And they're not so much interested in trying to save the literally tens of thousands of jobs that are at stake in the state of Michigan and all across the Midwest, for that matter.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of jobs, really, because people don't realize is the interwoven connectedness of not only the manufacturers, the suppliers, but also the advertising revenues. Do you know that for every radio station, a third of all their revenue comes from U.S. auto suppliers?
Oh, I believe it. You know, and that's all across the country, Nancy. It's not just in Detroit, for instance.
Right.
We're talking about if you turn on local news, and no matter what city that you live in the United States of America, you will notice a lot, or have noticed, at least up until the beginning of this year, most of the ads that you see are local dealerships. They don't have the money for advertisements right now because of the economy, because of the fact that auto sales are down so much, and you're not seeing those ads as much as you used to.
Right, and then the other thing that people, the unintended consequence here, is commercial real estate has been just on the brink of being going the way of what has happened to the housing industry. And with these many dealers in the United States essentially going bankrupt, you got a lot of commercial real estate that could be tipped into, you know, and then REITs, which are trade them in commodities that get traded, then you've jeopardized yet another commodity. All right, John, let's move on a little bit because I'm going to get back to that. But here, honestly, I do want to ask you this. So you were at the press conference last night, right?
Yes.
The swine flu, you know, I think that there is a hysteria surrounding this that is not as lethal as, say, you know, the worst nightmare scenario. Yeah, people are acting like it is, and it's consumed so much of the coverage, and it was the first, what, two questions or something last night?
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, is this just an easy question for reporters to grapple? When you have your shot, when you get to stand up and ask the President of the United States a question, you really want to take your shot and ask him about the swine flu?
Well, it depends what your outlet is, Nancy. For instance, the second question was about Chrysler, was about the auto companies, and the person that asked that question was from
Deb
Detroit
Price.
News.
Yeah.
So it really depends what your outlet is, what your focus is in terms of the news organization that you work for. And I think that for the Associated Press reporter that led off the news conference, the focus of the AP over the past week or so has been the swine flu virus story, and that's the reason why she asked that particular question.
Now, you have not been called on yet in the three press conferences, have you?
No, I haven't. In fact, I missed the first one. I was out of town, but the past two I have not. And last night there were 13 people that were in the room that got to ask questions of the president.
So you have to have one ready just in case, right?
Oh, absolutely.
What was your question?
Well, an issue that confounds me and confounds a lot of people that I speak with when I get a chance to travel around the country is the promise coming out of the president's stimulus plan of creating or saving 3.5 million jobs. We all, of course, understand what a created job is. It's a new job.
Mm-hmm.
But there's never been a standard upon which any president has been measured for saving jobs. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a measurement for the jobs that are gained in the U.S. economy, the number of jobs that are lost in the U.S. economy. There's no measurement for saved jobs. So my question has to do with whether we should rely on President Obama, his administration, to come up with what that figure is, and whether he believes this administration should be judged by a different standard than every other president as it relates to creating jobs for the U.S. economy.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, John, because I yesterday on the 100-day anniversary, I said to myself, what perspective we're missing here is what would have happened had the stimulus and all these bills not gone into effect? Because we know that the GDP fell 6.1%, but we don't know what it would have fallen. It could have been 10%. I mean, if you didn't have that combination of the fiscal stimulus, of the housing bills that slowed, as we saw, even though housing values fell, they fell by less than they had the previous month. So there is no one measuring what would have happened as we, you know, had we not taken those measures. And so it's really unfair to just look at how much he spent without saying, well, if you didn't spend that, what would have been the cost? And
right.
So who's measuring that? You are correct. There is really no one who could have looked at that trajectory like they do in retrospect for recessions and say, here's where we would have been.
sure. And there's no way of figuring that out accurately. We don't know what the GDP measurement would have been for the first quarter had not the stimulus bill been signed on February 17th. And keep in mind, that's a month into the first quarter in and of itself. So it's a big question. It's an unanswered question, and perhaps we'll get an opportunity to ask that at a future press conference.
Now, you know which question I thought I was the best question of the night? It was Jeff Zelenik, New York Times. When he asked the press, and I kind of missed it a little bit, and we're trying to pull this up, but he said, what surprised you the most, what troubled you the most, enchanted you the most, and humbled you the most? Were you surprised? Because that's all of a sudden like, wow, this is a question that's going to throw him for a loop, and yet not so much. He didn't get thrown for the loop. I think he took it, and he ate it up.
Well, he is a very thoughtful president in terms of the way that he answers questions, and I think that that question in particular forces the president to think and not just give a rote answer that he's used to giving for so many other questions that get posed of him on a weekly basis. So I think in that regard, it was a good question. It made the president think. It made the president sort of, you watched his mind working to some extent to come up with the answers to that four-part question.
Right, because the other ones, I'm sure it's almost like debate prep. They go over and over every possible question, right?
Absolutely.
And so the creative, like, I think your question would have been something that wouldn't have been on that list. How do you measure jobs that were saved? How do we measure what would have happened? That's probably not something that they have thought of.
Right.
So, well, we won't tell anyone that that's your question in case the next...
Well, here goes one for you, given that we're in the midst of the Stanley Cup playoffs and you're from Hockey Town, USA.
Yes.
Do you know the president's never been to a professional hockey game in his life?
I did not know that.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's because he planned on attending a Stanley Cup hockey game over the course of the next few weeks.
I don't think he wants to come to Detroit right now. or maybe he does as a cheerleader, because I do believe, I'll tell you this, I do believe that he and his auto team have wanted, believe in this auto industry. I do know this. I know they worked hard. They want to see this industry succeed.
Oh, absolutely.
They you know, that they were, because the polls were way upside down on this one. 76% of Americans said that they did not want to give another dollar to the auto industry. So they had to swallow hard to really push through this deal. And I just think that they got to this entanglement with these hedge funds where they had no choice but to say, okay, we're going to take our chance in bankruptcy court.
Well, that may be the case, and it we'll have to find out in the coming weeks and months. But I think that to some extent, the president's auto task force thought it was going to be a much easier sell than it is to these hedge funds that weren't going to blink and did not blink, and they're willing to test it out in bankruptcy court because they believe that they have bankruptcy law on their side to get the most out of what they think their investment is worth. They believe that they can get more out of a liquidation of Chrysler than what the Obama administration was essentially offering them, was about 29 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, you know what, fine, we'll go to bankruptcy court and get it that
Here's
way.
A problem, John. There is a provision in the code that could justify that. I hate to say politics can enter into this, but you're a White House correspondent. So you know this. You should dig up whose docket that lands on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you figure out who appointed that judge, because there is a pro, you know, there's going to be either a pro or anti-union component to this.
You're right. If a pro-business and a pro-labor point of view that bankruptcy judges may have.
Absolutely. And if people think that doesn't factor in because they have a lot of latitude where they could go side with those people if they want to see this company dissolve, they could take the side of the other side, and they could separate the companies and sell them off and get out of that first lien obligation. So politics matter in this, and that's why surgical or clean rinse thing I've been saying on the show, like, please, everything is politics.
Right.
But so, John, we're glad you joined us, and you had a great question, and next time we'll be rooting for you to be picked on, so you can come back, okay?
Great. Thanks a lot.
John
Andy,
Decker
have a great
is,
day.
You bet, White House correspondent with Reuters Television. He was at the press conference last night. We're going to continue with some of your calls here. 1-888-64, Nancy. Clean rinse. Yeah, right. I'm telling you. Politics, it's going to come into play just like it does with every other decision, right, that comes up. You got to see who appointed that judge now. And if you think that doesn't matter, well, then I got some commercial real estate on some dealership lots. I can sell you cheap. 1-888-64-NANCY.
What's the use of getting it, y'all? Sharing the odds. I'm straining from the fall, but staring. You become my magnificent affection. So how about joining my loving session?
Oh, what do you know? Reading in the Los Angeles Times, scientists see this new strain as relatively mild. Genetic data indicate this won't be as deadly as 1918, or even, say, an average winter, subheadline. Yet we're paralyzed in the grip of it. Oh my God, the Drudge Report headlined. Oh, the someone in the Mexican trip, there's a health advisory. White House issues health advisory for Obama's Mexico trip 13 days ago. Someone who was on the trip has a runny nose. Yet the auto industry could just slide into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and they're still just wall-to-wall swine flu. I tell you this. This hysteria is... These doctors are saying this is... It's very mild flu. We should not be freaking out about this. And the things we should be freaking out about, apparently we aren't. So if you don't think that when I talk about the power of the media, oh my Lord, Donna is up first. Hi, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you.
I wanted to offer a little bit of a clarification on politics in the bankruptcy court.
Sure.
You're absolutely right. Some bankruptcy judges are more pro-labor, some would be more pro-management. But you can't look to the president that appointed the bankruptcy judge the way you might for another federal judge, because bankruptcy judges are not appointed by the president. They do not have lifetime appointments. They serve for a 14-year period. And they are appointed by the judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals in the circuit in which they serve. So there's
But they're twice removed. So, you know, circuit courts are uniformly of a bent or another, as in the San Francisco Circuit Court, Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals is, you know, always a punching bag. So New York, I guess I'm wondering what that would mean. Donna, do you know? Who's
I think that I'm most familiar with the Bankruptcy Court in Los Angeles, and that bench is considered to be more pro-debtor than creditor, and that may be the result of a certain bent of the Ninth Circuit. I don't know about the New York courts, though.
Yeah, okay.
I do think that the courts in Delaware, the bankruptcy courts in Delaware,
sorry, Donna, I'm going to say, we'll come back. Nancy Skinner Show.
The notion that, as he said, and as many members of the team have said, and as many members involved in this agreement have done, which is make sacrifices in order for a company to move forward. There are those that decided that those steps could be taken, and there were those that decided they would... given your ratios, ask for more than twice that amount. I think the sacrifices that have been made by all those involved haven't been made by all. That's why the president made the comments that he did. But again, I'd reiterate, the president believes this is a good agreement.
When you said that nobody blinked, it might sound to some that the outcome the administration would most prefer from the bankruptcy proceeding is to give those who thought somebody might blink punishment less than they were seeking.
Well,
is that the outcome that you'd like to see?
I don't want to prejudge the outcome, except to say that there were offers on the table that that we thought and others thought were fair, and I think they had every ability and right to take them.
Following up on Ed's question, I know the president doesn't want to be in the automotive business, and everyone can understand why, but there was a previous merger with Chrysler and a very well-known, world-dominating brand, Daimler Benz. That didn't work out for all sorts of reasons. Clash of cultures, design, engineering, things didn't match up. Why is it that a brand name that has less clout within Europe and the U.S. market, Fiat, is going to work when Daimler Chrysler didn't?
Two reasons. One, they have expertise in restructuring that we think and that others think make this a viable partnership. And secondly, their expertise and know-how in the creation and the manufacturing of more fuel-efficient engines, which, to build off of Ed's question on car sales, you know, I don't think it's altogether surprising that Hummer is not a dealer or brand name that's likely going to survive this economic downturn. It didn't necessarily do so well during $4.50 a gallon gas either. The president talked about in his remarks and has said on any number of occasions over the years that what we have to do is we have to have American auto companies that are building cars that American consumers have a demand for and want to buy. And I think the example with Fiat provides expertise.
Okay, that's from spokesperson, White House spokesperson Robert Gibbs on the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. The reason I wanted to play a little bit of that, a very interesting exchange between he and Major Garrett of Fox News. Oh, by the way, that was Fox News, and I will be appearing on a Fox Business Network special presentation on the auto industry this evening at 9:30 p.m. So if you want to tune in, you will see it's a special on the auto industry. I'm quite sure I'll be the only pro-U.S. auto industry panelist on the program, should you care to see me battle it out. But Major Garrett saying, well, don't those hedge funds have a right to their day in court? Those poor little hedge funds that bought the junk bonds, shouldn't they liquidate an entire industry? What about patriotism in this whole argument? What about patriotism that everybody came to the table? Everybody came to the table for this country and we, the taxpayers, have put so much of our money on the line. They're throwing tea parties because of all these American values about patriotism, right? And and this just crass individualism that says you really want to liquidate an industry because instead of taking 33 cents on a dollar, you're going to hold out for 65 cents on the dollar. That is what this boils down to, okay? That is why this small group of hedge funds is going to drag this through bankruptcy court, and Lord knows what's going to happen in the interim. The other thing that Major Garrett had a big problem with is, are you trying to control the technology? Do you really want those cars? Why this technology? And I think Gibbs is like, because they have technology and fuel efficiency. And then you're gonna see this big question. Well, why should it be the government's role to say whether we have fuel efficient technology?
Manufacturing move to put those more cars on the market in the hopes that they will be purchased. I'm sorry. Is this a manufacturing move? I mean, Fiat gets more percentage of the company that meets some thresholds. One of them is introducing this fuel-efficient technology. Second is introducing a 40-mile-per-gallon vehicle. It might look to some as if the government is not just suggesting, but creating larger equity for Fiat by producing a certain kind of vehicle for a market.
Two responses. One, I think the president was pretty clear that Fiat can't take a majority ownership in a merged company unless or until American taxpayers have been paid back in whole. Two, regardless of why, the president and I think a vast majority of the public believes that more fuel-efficient automobiles are in the best interest of this country, whether it lessens the demand for oil and gas and makes us less dependent on foreign oil, whether they emit less harmful pollutants. I think that many involved, both at a government and a private sector level, see the strong desire for more energy efficient automobiles.
You know, it's probably a good thing I'm not White House press secretary, because I would have said, Major, this is pretty simple. We need greener cars. We need that technology, Major, because we're national security, global warming, jobs, dude. Do you not get that? Come on, Major. Tell me you get that. I probably wouldn't be good right now. So anyways, that's the thing. It's like this is what you're going to see in all the editorials. Is, oh, the government wants to run. No, it's Obama Motors, and they want to direct all the technology. Well, you know what? It may just be that that's what has to happen, because it hasn't happened, and we are in a special circumstance. And the idea that we can just let them go down the tubes, because those hedge funds have a right. They have a right to liquidate an entire industry and jeopardize our national security. I mean, come on, people. This is a national security issue if you do not have an American manufacturing industry. I would make that case in court. Absolutely. John is up next. Hi, John.
Hello. You've got disaster capitalism at its finest, or its worst, depending on your point of view. But I smell a rat. I don't know what the total dollar amount is that we're talking about, the hedge funds, what they're holding, but I would expect that prior to any entry or consideration of bankruptcy court, that somebody would have had the foresight to take these guys out, one way or the other. Do you know what the numbers happen to be?
Well, you know, I know there are 50 of them. I think, I don't know what their total share of the outstanding debt is. The banks had up $6.9 billion, and they are taking $2 billion in cash. But I don't know what these smaller hedge funds are doing. But it's the number of them that gets tricky in the bankruptcy court. That's why they feel that the court will be on their side, because according to the bankruptcy rule, the laws, where did I put this?
Yeah, but the point is that they should have been taken out well before they entered bankruptcy court. Somebody should have had the foresight to buy them out.
Well, yeah, you know, I don't know what happened, how they got to the point where they got a large, here you go. As of late Wednesday, it wasn't clear whether the government would be able to satisfy the majority requirement under bankruptcy law, as a large number of Chrysler's nearly 50 senior creditors had voted against its repayment plan, and the big banks refused to budge. So, you know what? It's greed versus greed.
You got that right.
Who wins?
Anyway, good luck, Nancy. I'll speak with you later.
Thanks, bye-bye. John. Appreciate the call. So that's why this gets tricky, you know. But John's point is, hey, maybe that they are hanging in there for a purpose, and it is to do that, to bust the unions. Because I'll tell you what, you take apart a company like this, and the UAW takes a hit, and it will reverberate. And the UAW is, I believe, it's the largest union. 1-888-64 Nancy. Let's move on to Los Angeles and talk to Phil. Hi, Phil.
How you doing, Nancy?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks.
First of all, I really enjoy your show. You've done a wonderful job filling in. And I'm a Teamster out here. I'm also a shop steward, and I'm also an activist in the union. And I got to tell you, this is a bad day. You know, this is not going to be good for the workers. And as you frequently mention on your show, this is blue-collar versus the white-collar worker in the end. And one of the first things that they teach you in labor law, too, is they show you a film of United Airlines when they did the restructuring. And, you know, this is going to be, to me, what I see coming down the pipe here is something terrible for the workers. You know, I voted for Barack Obama, but correct me if I'm wrong, Nancy, I believe he did vote yes on this bankruptcy bill when he was in the Senate.
No, he did not.
He did not?
No.
Okay.
No, he did not. I know that to be a fact.
Okay. Okay, well.
Now, the vice president did, but he's from Delaware. But President Obama voted against the bankruptcy bill.
Okay, well, thank you for clarifying that for me.
Yeah.
However, when you take a look at what happened at the restructuring at United, you know, you take workers that have already retired, put their 30 years in, and just a clear number, say they retire with $3,000, they turn around and lose 33% of their pension overnight. And, you know, this is something that can happen, I don't know. I just don't look for anything great to come out of this. Once they get in this mode, you know, the workers are going to be the ones that suffer.
Yeah.
And you know, I got to tell you, and, you know, people, you don't have to have a college education to have common sense. And I'll tell you right now, people assemble the cars that they're told to assemble. It's not the workers' fault. You know, it's just like in the job where I work at, I do what I'm told to do. If the company, you know, if the company were to go under, it's because of decisions they've made. It's not the workers. It's not the union.
You're so correct in that, Phil, because I'll tell you what. When I ran for Congress here, I was my biggest backer was the UAW. And I was running on the platform of retooling these vehicles that they needed, green vehicles, running those commercials about global warming in the home of the auto industry with the complete support of the UAW. They did phone banks for me. They engaged me. They realized that the longevity of their jobs depended on them eventually embracing this technology. It was management who was seeing short-term profits tied to the sale of these high-margin SUVs that were fighting them. So it wasn't the fat, you know, workers wanting SUVs. There was a certain strategic planning that the UAW knew that when they sold these vehicles that they're going to have more workers making them, and they don't care which, you know, what they were making, but the fact that they knew that the future was green technology shifted their focus.
I just want to make one more comment. I am a Teamster, and you are from Detroit, and you know, when you're talking about
Jimmy Hoffa lives in my district. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I just want to say that you know, union members need to take a good look at what's going on, because I'm going to tell you, I'm not a Jimmy Hoffa supporter either. I supported a grassroots guy named Tom Leadham in the last international election. You know, he's done more concessionary giveaways in Master Freight. UPS has just switched in the central and southern states to a 401k plan, and this is hugely detrimental to the Teamsters. You know, that's what we're about, is our pensions, and that's what they're after in the UAW. You know, union workers, along with school teachers and other people, as well as you know, are about retiring with a little bit of dignity and respect. And it's really sad the position our country's in, especially today. I mean, I just really feel bad. My heart goes out to those workers. My mother graduated from MSU. And, you know, I don't know. I could go on and on, but I love your show. And I just want to say that, you know, I hope that all union people decide to pull together. We need to pull the AFL-CIO back together with the Teamsters, the Carpenters Union.
Yeah, I agree.
Workers,
I agree.
We need to all come to a head and get this Employee Free Choice Act passed, because if we don't, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. You have a nice day, Nancy.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
I am with you, my friend. We got to put this beyond the unions. You know, it's just average people here, okay, that don't get $100 million bonuses on $600 million pre-tax profits because you've been trading in oil commodities. There is a us and them, and there is a Main Street Wall Street thing, and it's true that the greed of a small group of people could jeopardize the well-being of just normal people who are working hard their whole lives. And I trust the president. I do. I think he fought as hard as he possibly could, and he believes that there's going to be a good outcome to this. But, man, don't talk to me about patriotism. Do not talk to me about patriotism. If you're one of these greedy hedge fund people, okay, who showed up at a tea party or whatever, oh, with your flags and all your crap. Because patriotism is about doing what is best for the whole country. And sometimes that means everybody, even hedge fund managers, got to give. And that means Citigroup, you're not going to get your bonuses this time around this year. If we all recover from this and things go back to normal and we find a reasonable solution so this doesn't happen again, great. I'm a capitalist. I'm a finance major. God love you. I want you to make money. But greed will destroy this country. And that's where we're at. And we are on that brink. We have to decide. Who's this guy in the paper? Gwynn. Mr. Gwynn, you have to decide. Are you so mad about what happened to your father, who recovered, by the way, was helped, that you want to destroy Detroit? Mr. Gwynn, you want to go into court to get back? So you're going to get back at 80,000 retirees because you were hurt personally? Please. 1-888-64-NANCY.
banks, the biggest stakeholders in this whole process have already aligned, have already agreed. This process will be quick. It will be efficient. It's designed to deal with those last few holdups, and it will be controlled. It will not disrupt the lives of the people who work at Chrysler or live in communities that depend on it. And it will not affect the ability of American consumers to buy a Chrysler or to get it serviced and repaired. It's a process that has the full support of Chrysler's key stakeholders and the full backing of the United States government. And I have every confidence that Chrysler will emerge from this process stronger and more competitive. I know that there are some who will insist that bankruptcy, even for these limited purposes, is a step that should not have been taken. But it was unsustainable to let enormous liabilities remain on Chrysler's books, and it was unacceptable to let a small group of speculators endanger Chrysler's future by refusing to sacrifice like everyone else. So I recognize that the path we're taking is hard, but as is often the case, the hard path is the right one.
That's the president today in a press conference on the auto industry. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. That makes me Nancy Skinner in Detroit, not in Mexico, going through everything I was hoping I wouldn't, actually. 1-888-64-NANCY. You know what bums me out? I called, one of my favorite books is Where Have All the Leaders Gone by Lee Iacocca, Chrysler CEO who got Chrysler through their problems in the 80s and became a big cheerleader for the industry, saying he tapped into the latent U.S. patriotism by saying, preaching a Made in America is best theme, and saying if you can find a better car, go ahead and buy it, right? Helped really turn that company around. I called his office to have him come on the show, and they said he's decided not to do any interviews. That was one of my favorite books, Where Have All the Leaders Gone, about courage, the 12 C's. We really need people to take this tough path about manufacturing, about everything the president just said. And he's decided, he's in California now, not to give any comment on the fate of Chrysler right now. And that's kind of disappointing. This is my favorite book. Where are all the leaders now? In times of darkness. President, I hope you are right, Mr. President. I have my full faith and confidence in you. It is a tough path, though, I assure you, as we will continue on the Nancy Skinner Show. Nancy's going to show 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 1-888-646-2629, the number to the program. It's the Arlen Specter at the press conference last night at the newsroom. Did anybody see him there? Because I didn't see him, like, in the background. Made his flip, and I think he's dealing with the results, sort of to see where he can, where the marbles will roll in terms of how much power this brings to the senator himself, and what effect it has on Washington, and what's going to happen. A lot of people still gaming that out. But my question was, did the party leave Arlen Specter, or did Arlen Specter leave the party, really? You know, all this talk about Pennsylvania and 200,000 voters who changed their registration from Republican to Democrat, Well, why is that? Is it because they were so attracted to the message of President Obama, or because they were scared off by the right-wing crazies in on the GOP side? So let's dig into that a little deeper with Representative Frank Dermody. He is a state legislator from Pennsylvania in the 33rd legislative district. That's Allegheny County in western PA, which I think from my time in Pennsylvania and my travails through there is pretty conservative. And Representative Dermody joins us now. Thanks so much for joining me, Frank.
It's great to be here.
How would you tell us a little bit, first of all, you're in the 33rd District, Allegheny County. Tell us a little bit about Western PA, because we're all trying to figure out what happened.
Well, you know, I live about 12 miles north and east of Pittsburgh. So Allegheny County, Pittsburgh, is the main city, obviously, and it's a big, you know, it's a major city in the western part of the state. But I think you're right. The western part of the state is probably a little bit more conservative. Allegheny County is a Democratic area, but it's a middle-of-the-road conservative Democratic area.
Because you got, like, Butler, Pennsylvania. You got Harmony, PA, right?
Sure. I'm right outside on the Allegheny River, outside of Pittsburgh. Butler is very close to where my district, yes.
Because I went to a football game in Butler, Seneca High versus Butler, okay?
All right. So you know the area.
Yeah, I do. And you know what? When I was there during the election, it was loaded with McCain-Palin signs, frankly, going through the beautiful countryside there.
But it's beautiful countryside. I'm Butler County, obviously, probably, you know, I know, voted for McCain. Allegheny County was won handily by Obama, though.
So you're just a little closer to the Pittsburgh center line.
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay. So tell us what changed there. Why, in your view, a representative, did these 200,000 voters change their registration? Was there anything going on in terms of Pennsylvania politics that did this, or is this a larger issue of manufacturing, industrial economy, messaging of Obama? What was going on, in your view?
It's all part of that, but I believe that the Republican Party has become more and more conservative, and there, you know, there's a moderate wing, there's a moderate part of that party that's significant, and it's becoming harder and harder to be a moderate Republican, and it's particularly in southeastern Pennsylvania. That's where most of those registration changes took place, and that's because I don't believe that they, and I think Arlen Specter was right, there's no longer any room for him. I mean, in western Pennsylvania, we're, you know, there's conservative Democrats, and, you know, the registration edge is Democrat, and, you know, my district voted very, very narrowly for McCain. But it was very, very close. And Allegheny County was handily, you know, for Obama. So it's a conservative area, but there's becoming less and less room for moderate Republicans in the Republican Party in Pennsylvania.
Now, you're a Democrat, and McCain carried your district. So
not very close, but it was very close. He worked hard for Obama, and it was close. And it was, you know, 100 votes or so. I mean, it wasn't like it was a rout at all, but it was close.
Yeah, but in this cycle where you saw such a hunger for change, you'd think you'd have a bigger margin if it were truly Democratic. So in other words, you probably have been trending more Democratic in Allegheny.
Yeah, we're trending a little more Democratic in Allegheny. As you farther get away from the city, it gets a little bit
the other way. How did you do it? How did you win as a Democrat in that mixed bag?
Well, I've been there, you know, 19 years, and people know me, but it's getting difficult. The margins have gotten closer. But, you know, in my House seat, there's 60,000 people. I mean, I can go door to door, and I do every election. I have to talk about what we've done in Harrisburg and talk about our message. But I think what also is resounding here, and I think that you're going to see Barack Obama's popularity increase, is that he's taking charge. He cares about working men and women, and he knows that we have to do something to get people back to work. And that resounds in western Pennsylvania.
So it's bread and butter issues, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now, one of the ongoing issues, or I guess this is a recent issue that has been raised on my program here, is because I think I live in Detroit, sir,
right.
So you know what we're going through right now.
Yeah.
And I do think that that's what people are hurting, and that message was really about, we really got to resolve some of these big challenges along those lines. But there's a certain anger toward President Bush that persists among both, you know, I think the resentment among Republicans for the because of, you know, the war in Iraq and the torture and whatnot, that there is a certain group of my listeners, I know for sure, that want to see immediate the commencement of investigations into the crimes, alleged crimes of the Bush administration right now. if that were to happen, you live in this moderate district, how do you think that would play? Do you think that that would affect them, that people would feel a sense of, well, this is what, you know, this is the world nation of laws, this must be done? Or do you think they would get turned off by that?
Look, I believe that they firmly believe that my district believes that we are a nation of laws, but that we have significant problems that we have to deal with that are concerned educating, feeding my children, educating our children. You know, we have to get jobs. And I think that I agree with the president on this issue that while it's important, I think we need to look into it. He also has a lot on his plate, a significant amount of issues on his plate, that what we ought to be concerned about the most right now is getting people back to work, making sure, you know, families can educate their kids and take care of their families.
And then just to sort of wrap this up here, so our inspector, this was really no one's really shocked, right? He'd been trending, he'd been an independent, if you will, for a long time.
Right.
Now you got to look at who to recruit, you know, who's going to come up, and this Phil Toomey, is he going to have any challengers in the primary?
Well, you know, Pat Toomey, you didn't have any. Well, apparently right now, there's several news articles today that Tom Ridge is being asked to run. They find a moderate, once again. Tom is considered to be a moderate against Toomey because they understand that the Republicans just can't win with these far right-wing candidates. Arlen Specter, you know, won his Senate races because Democrats in western Pennsylvania voted for him.
Because of his moderate views.
His moderate views. He's always worked closely with the unions, and he's kept the relationships up there. I mean, I've worked with politicians over the years, and his staff. They've been great. So he's nurtured the relationships on both sides of the aisle, and he needed to do that to win in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a moderate in Pennsylvania. And I think all in all, when you look at how this state performs, you know, we're not real liberal, but it's a moderate state, and the real extremes don't work.
Right. So last question is this. So Governor Rendell, is he term limited in 2000? Is he up in 2010?
Yeah, he's done. He has two terms. He's ending up next year.
So why didn't he have his eye on the Senate seat?
Talked to him about that.
You know what I'm saying? It would be a natural, it would seem to me that would be a natural progression for him, but yet he talked Arlen Specter into flipping.
Well, I think that's a good thing. And he may want to take a break. I don't know if he wants to run again. It's been rough. These last 2 years have been difficult. And this last budget the budget we have to do this year is going to be very difficult. So he may want to take a break.
Yeah, every state's going through that. Trust me.
Michigan is going.
You don't want to be Michigan right now. We already had 12% unemployment. We've been in recession for 8 years technically. And now with this cascading effect of the auto companies, it could be uglier than anything you'll deal with in Pennsylvania, but
We went through that with the demise of the steel industry in the 80s.
Yeah, you did.
And we've dealt with it, and it hasn't been as bad in the Pittsburgh region as it has been in other areas. We obviously have problems, but thank goodness we've been able to work with them.
Well, we'll just hope that our outcome is as bright as yours was in Pennsylvania. Representative Frank Dermody, thank you so much for joining me. Appreciate the insight.
Thank you, Nancy.
You bet. Yeah. Steel industry, they did it. A lot of comparisons made along those lines. I haven't really delved into how much. I think the auto is a little bigger, but I don't know. And plus, that didn't happen in the midst of a global economic meltdown with a credit crisis and a housing crisis piled on top. Big crap sandwich. So, 1-888-64 Nancy. The number to the program as we continue. I had to get that question in there about this is a moderate guy in a moderate district, okay? Try to get the votes to get the stuff done for people. I know that just drives some people crazy when I talk about real people hurting, but that's what's driving politics, and that's why President Obama has the highest rating, because he keeps his eye on the ball. April 30th, It's going to be an important day, I assure you of that, for those people who think that the whole surgical bankruptcy thing is just easy for the auto industry and that we don't really need a U.S. auto industry. Just write that down. Just put that on a cocktail napkin, okay? Stick it away for history's sake. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. That's 646-2629. Get a couple calls in here quickly. Hi, Ryan. Hello, Ryan. You got to turn your phone down or your radio down there in Buffalo.
Hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
Oh, great. Thank you.
I was just wondering how we get out of the economic crisis by creating more debt.
Well, because the spending, you understand what, do you know what deflation means?
Yeah.
Okay. So we had to spend money because when you have a cycle where no one is spending money because there was a glut of goods and you used every monetary policy, lowered interest rates down to zero, which is the other way, the first way, the fiscal way, then the only other way that you can prevent a complete meltdown is to spend money. Okay, it's called fiscal stimulus. It's Keynes, John Maynard Keynes. It's a Keynesian theory. And both the conservative economists and liberal economists, whatever, all agree that it's the only mechanism to get, when everyone stops spending, and huge inventories of goods pile up, as they have. And that's why you're seeing all these companies with too much inventories. Well, then the only thing you can do is spend and have the government is the only entity large enough at that point, juncture, to spend to get people, keep people from getting unemployed and worsening the cycle, number one, and two, sort of easing them so that they can start eventually spending again, and then that puts more people back to work. But it's a vicious cycle. Think of it that way. And if you don't stop it with some spending, then it's going to cycle out of control, and it would be far, far worse than what we're experiencing now.
Shouldn't we kind of lower taxes on the middle class, though, and so then they could save more money?
Well, President Obama did on the middle class.
Not necessarily.
500, whatever it was, he just already passed a working, making America pay a middle-class tax cut. And just lowering taxes, as President Bush did over 8 years on the wealthy, does not fix that, Ryan. Do you get this? Because it's not about getting people to incentivize the rich to make more junk. We have enough junk. Yeah. Inventories are piled high. That's the problem. You have to get people that earn money, making more money, feeling more confident that they're not going to lose their jobs so they don't hoard their money. And so a tax cut that happens once a year isn't this really the solution. It's a tiny little piece of it. But this is an emergency measure reserved only for a situation like this that happens a couple, you know, it's only happened once before. And there was no other way to try and get this economy back into shape again but to infuse it with money. And the Fed yesterday reported that we're starting to see some green spots, some signs that the absolute crash has stalled and we're starting to pick up steam. And then what you do is as we recover, as the president said, when we do recover, you got to go through that budget line by line and cut out programs that are unnecessary. And there's going to be corporate welfare in there. There's going to be all kinds of programs. And, yes, deficits do matter eventually.
Yeah, because what happens if China stops buying our debt? Then what are we going to do?
That's right. You're right. Eventually it does matter. But not when you're in emergency. When you're in the ER, it's about saving the patient. It's not about worrying about, you know, some long-term, far-off issue. Well, and that's what we had to do.
There's a lot of economists that believe what we're doing right now is wrong.
No, they're not. No, there are a small number of ideological economists.
Ideological as in being what?
Conservative ideological economists who are fighting this along political lines. But true economists, you have Reagan-era economists who are saying.
Libertarian economists are. No, I've been saying this since Bush that our spending is out of control. It's not since just because Obama's in.
Not about spending. About what they're saying is that a stimulus is the only thing that could have prevented a depression.
I don't know about that.
I think all economists agree that over the long run, deficits. Structural deficits, Ryan, if you don't even know what a structural deficit is, we really can't have an intelligent conversation here. But
okay.
Do you know what a structural deficit is?
No.
Okay. Well, a structural deficit is a sustained, it's not an ebb and flow. it's a sustain, like President Bush gave us structural deficits because he spent so much money that it's chronic in every single year. Then you have effects on a monetary policy across the globe. That's, we were handed a structural deficit issue on top of a deflationary downward spiral, and that is not a good combination, like in chemistry class. But we'll continue at 1-888-64-NANCY.
These creditors, what gives you any assurance that this can be done in 30 to 60 days? Those creditors will walk into bankruptcy court. They'll have rights. They'll have an opportunity to litigate, market test that fiat deal, say that liquidation would be more beneficial. I mean, this could stretch out months.
When you mean beneficial, beneficial to whom?
Well, to the creditors. I think it's black letter bankruptcy law that if you can get more liquidation, the judge can't rubber stamp another deal.
Right.
So
well,
I guess what I'm saying is, why do you think it's going to be quick?
Because we feel confident that a majority of the stakeholders, a vast majority of the stakeholders are on board with a deal that we think is in the interest of all of those involved. And we think we can convince that a judge can be convinced of that.
If it goes on beyond 30, 60 days,
well,
is that DIP financing enough?
Well, let's not get 61 days into the equation, and we'll have any number of opportunities to do that as we get closer. Again, we feel confident that the structure of the agreement, the sacrifices that have been made by the vast majority of those involved in the operations of Chrysler give this deal an excellent chance of working.
Is the president trying to influence that the bankruptcy judge in terms of vis-a-vis how those creditors are treated?
I assume judges make opinions based on what's their reading of the law, not based on what any individual
is. The judge can be convinced. And the
well, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think it's safe to assume that we will present a case. And render an opinion as to why we think the deal is workable, why we're confident that a majority of the stakeholders involved are on board, and why we think it's in the best interest of all those involved.
Real quick, did the president talk to the vice president about his statements on the Today Show? And would you characterize his reaction?
Okay, on to more important things.
He's been so careful about how
Vice President Biden's statements about flu. More important, I suppose. Forget 30 or 60 days, folks. Here's local news coming out of Detroit. Chrysler's bankruptcy filing triggered an immediate and unplanned shutdown at plants through Metro Detroit as suppliers stopped shipping parts out of fear they won't be paid. Workers were sent home from Warren Truck, Warren Stamping, and Sterling Stamping plants this afternoon. Company plans to temporarily close all its factories beginning Monday and continuing through the bankruptcy process. But the immediate shutdowns illustrate how easily what has been billed as a surgical bankruptcy can quickly become messy. Let's see. Then there will be further capacity rationalization, which is slang for plant closings. The plants have been identified. They'll have to work through that because then that triggers contract changes for the UAW when their plants are shut down. Folks, what I've been trying to tell you here already, they are shutting down. Suppliers are shutting down today. It's in the courts one day, and they're afraid that they're going to not be paid. So they're shutting down because they have to watch their bottom line. I mean, how many times did we have to say that this was what was going to happen, and that things will spiral out of control? I mean, it didn't take 30 days. I wasn't on the air 3 hours, and workers were sent home, and suppliers are shutting down. And then what happens there? What, you know, take it to the next step. This is not rocket science, okay? That, you know, you're going to have sales fall off a cliff. I mean, there's liquidity problems, meaning payroll, more layoffs. You know, and these creditors, so it was a game of chicken that, You know, I wasn't in the inside of this thing, obviously, but these hedge funds that held out to the very end, even the banks, even Chase, after we went through all of everything we went through about that, were forced to come up with an arrangement because guess what? They need money, too. Their stress tests did not go so well. And so they're going to need more money. My guess is that they probably participated in the arrangement. But yet some greedy hedge fund junk bond holders are the ones who are setting this into this whole thing into a cascading effect today already. It didn't even take, you know, we'll give you dip financing for 30 days. Well, that's just not how it's going to work. Now, this isn't to say that the deal, the pressure gets on these people immediately, and I think that there needs to be a pressure applied. Obviously, I'll open it up to you for what needs to be done at this point. If you have a few holdouts of these companies, these hedge fund people who are willing to essentially liquidate an entire industry and let people let these companies walk away from their pensions, which will go to the Pension Guarantee Corporation of the federal government. That's you. So this is not just about us in Detroit. That's about this. This will be taking over the mother of all pensions out there. Something like, I think in total, 600,000 workers. Come on. You think that the United States of America is going to let these people just walk away from all of this? So what is to be done with these bondholders? I guess is the question I would put out there. 1-888-64-NANCY. And, you know, Chrysler, Mark Phelan's reporting, who was on the show earlier, that they need these, they have to start selling these Fiats quick. That's, you know, their solution is to get these new cars out there and get incentives for those new cars. But saw this one coming. Saw lots of things coming down the pike, I must say. And as much as I get some tough emails, I get some great emails. And this I saw coming a long time ago and been saying, heads up, heads up, heads up, heads up. And here we are. Let's go to Randall in Buffalo. Hi, Randall.
Hi, Nancy. Thanks for having me on again. It's always nice to talk to you. Listen, there's sort of a double-pronged point here. I've finally gained some respect for you. Not that I disrespected you before, but I finally started hearing this passion from you a week or 10 days ago about the auto industry, and I think some of the feedback you got from your listeners is that is more around you seem like the sort of wimpy centrist that didn't really, you know, you were dismissive of other people's passion on different topics and issues. But then I finally heard that from you about the auto thing, and you're absolutely correct. My big problem with Arlen Specter is just that. Some talk show host, I don't know, a couple years ago, made the point that that moderates in the Congress and Senate are just kind of wimps. They don't really stand for anything. You don't have to be an extremist, but, you know, they don't really stand or care about anything. They're just on the fence about, you know, everything. Arlen Specter is just like that. He would raise all these red flags during the Republicans' reign there when he had, you know, control over the committee. He'd raise all these red flags and get the headlines and then do nothing. Remember, he famously wouldn't swear in Alberto Gonzalez. Remember that, Pat Leahy's like, well, why not? We can, it's okay, you know, let's just swear a minute. It just takes a minute. He's like, no, I trust Alberto to be, you know, truthful. He knows he has to be honest. And then he was shocked that Alberto Gonzalez was lying to him, you know. And then he says, oh, we got to do something. We got to get these hearings. And then he did nothing, you know. So if he's going to come to the Democratic Party and be helpful to anybody in this country, he needs to take a stand on something.
Well, you know what? I think that what you're trying, with this distinction you're making, and the fact that you just heard me have some passion for the auto industry 10 days ago, is sort of funny. I've been at it a long, long time.
I know, but there are other topics that were more pressing, people were bringing, you know, up. And then about a week or 10 days ago, you're like, look, we're a week out from this thing, people. And you started really, like, just going at it. And I'm like, okay, now I understand.
Well,
now I understand.
You know, that's why I think the whole thing about the labels, I think labels they are just ridiculous. And I think that we can have a tendency, as a Democrat, we can have a tendency to be as attached to labels as Republicans do. And this whole battle that's going on with the moderates and the conservatives on the Republican side, that same battle is going on the Democratic side.
Oh, yeah.
Like, who's higher,
or
mightier? Because I'm more to the left of you on this or that. And I don't think that the president won the election by the margin he did because, you know, he went by labels. I think you can have passion. Obviously, I have passion. And I think there are issues. I rank things in terms of what I think is the important scale of humanity. Okay,
and
absolutely. Having a job and having a living, and then a climate that, you know, so that we don't have major disruptions and loss of life. Those kinds of things. And you gotta. And I think there is a philosophy. I know there is sort of. There's a name to this, but you know. I am as dismayed by the labels that, and this is a surprising journey for me because I started out as a pioneer in progressive radio. And, you know, at that time it was only, I was on the stage with Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity. There were no alternatives out there. And I got and I was like considered crazy that I would even do that. And then, you know, you get it on the other side when you're trying to address the needs of people. And I guess maybe it's because I'm from the Midwest and Detroit or whatever. And I see suffering, and I see how people, the anxiety that they feel. Maybe that is the difference or the disconnect that perhaps some of my friends who are mad at me because I'm not, you know, all over the torture thing. It's not that I'm not, or I don't think that there should be a time for that, or I don't think we're a nation of laws. But I do think that there is a priority. I do think that when people are in need now and hurting, and when you see that we have to prevent the worst from happening, and I think the president, I can see this strain in his, as he speaks. I think he knows we've got all these problems. I think it would be a luxury for him to engage in sort of partisan, the real, you know, stuff of going at those, the trials, because you know that they will suck all the media oxygen out, and he will not deal with these real concerns. And so I guess that's it. I mean, it's not that I lack passion. I'm not a moderate, mushy, well, on one hand, maybe this. On the other hand, that. No, I have very strong.
Right, exactly.
I have very defined and strong views, and how I prioritize them are what do we need to do right now? What is the most important thing that needs to be done right now? And yes, you can multitask. A lot of people say, well, we can do everything at once. You know what? You can't do everything at once. And if I can prove my point, look at the swine flu. The ridiculous hyperbole of this thing. There are 193 cases of this worldwide. 36,000 people die every year, and the media is so freaked out by this. It's like I rest my case that you can't do everything at once.
I understand, and it was the 24/7 for a year coverage of the Monica Lewinsky story that, you know, drug this nation down too because nothing else was getting focused. I agree. But to be honest with you, the first week you were on, or maybe early into the second week, I got a little turned off by you because you're like, oh, let's get to that in a couple, 3 years. And I'm like, no. There's always these midterms, and people always use this excuse, well, you can't do that, and, you know, prosecution's in an election year, or, you know, what happens if we lose the midterms this next year, and, you know, we can't prosecute because now we lost the committee, or, you know, it sounded like Congress speak. Well, we'll just get to that later.
No,
like, no.
You know, it's not what I'm saying, Randall.
No. I know you're not. I know, and I finally come to realize that. And what is great about Obama and yourself, you know, is that we have these priorities. They are ranked and listed, you know, but we can do some things all at the same time.
Sure, of course. Look at we're dealing with a global meltdown, a financial crisis, a housing crisis, a banking crisis, trying to save the auto industry. Lord knows if it's going to work. You know, two wars, swine flu and pirates, man. we're doing it.
I think we need to trust that Obama, and I do, I think he's completely on top of all of these things, and, you know, we'll just like he said, it's like we have to get health care passed this year. That's exactly my point.
Yeah, we do.
Now is the time to do it, because guess what? Next year, the year after, now it's an election year, right. And now it's, you know, can't do it because of blah. You know, it's like, God, just do it.
That's been going on for 30 years.
I know.
Same with energy policy.
Done.
And we've got 60 votes right now. This is the time, people.
It is. And we hate that Congress speak, the senator speak of, oh, we'll look at that in a few years, a few months.
No.
But come on!
Now. Now.
Right, exactly.
That's exactly where I am, Randall. Thanks a lot. I'm out of time.
I'm
appreciate
so glad
it.
You did. Yeah, thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Now. This is it. This is the time to get this stuff done. I wouldn't wait a day. I'd be introducing every bill that we can on these really, really 30 years in the making issues that really affect lives, that affect the future of our country. Really. Who knows? We'll follow the developments with the auto industry, but I've given you the news today. It's already begun. Remember, 30 days till GM. Same fate. GM bondholders to present alternative offer. They didn't like their offer, so they're going to get tougher now. They've decided that what they want is they're gonna take the offer that's on the table right now to them, and they're going to give them their own offer out that would give them 51% stake in this restructured company for their debt, $27 billion in debt. And guess how much the government would get for all of its help to General Motors? Zero. That's the new offer from the GM bondholders. The government would get nothing, according to officials familiar with the offer. Do you think they feel emboldened? I think they do. So would you like to see a Chrysler, then a GM bankruptcy? And if you don't think it matters to your bottom line in the economy, and you don't think it's going to prolong this recession, that, I, you know, give me some of what you got, what you're drinking, the Kool-Aid. Because when GM files for breathing, Chrysler's bankruptcy is already starting the ripple effect. You wait till the largest name in manufacturing files for Chapter 11. Then I don't care what state you live in or what profession you're in or if you're a hedge fund holder or whatever you are, a janitor, it'll affect you. Let's go out to Sunrise, Florida and get Flo into the program. Hi, Flo.
Nancy?
Yes.
I'd like to thank you for being on this subject. That's why I'm listening to you. And I really appreciate it. My husband works for a car dealership, Chrysler Jeep. And they've already cut back his hours. But hasn't this been a roller coaster ride? Up and down for months?
It has. And the sad thing about it is that, you know, we've been trying to make the case. I mean, it was truly indefensible that the executive showed up and in their jet. And, you know, I was against them on that. I've been trying to advise them for years that they needed to move. But yeah,
they got a caravan, remember? The second time they came to the table, they had a caravan.
But it's funny, Flo, when you say that, you know, I heard the reporting today was, or in the press conference with Robert Gibbs, a reporter actually said, well, no one's buying these cars anymore, so why? And I'm driving around now. I'm in Detroit, obviously, but I'm in a Chrysler. The two cars in front and behind me, next to me, were all Chryslers. I mean, there's lots of Fords. There are very few foreign vehicles driven around here. But, but you know, the fact is, Gibbs said, look it, they are, no one's buying cars. Toyota's down, Nissan's down, everybody is down, every retailer is down. There is a piling on of the U.S. auto industry that I can't understand why there is such, you know, negativity toward.
What's really behind it? Because the Business Channel, they're negative, too. I mean, that one lady, I can't think of her name right now, she said, why is it so important that they survive? And I thought to myself, what is wrong with this woman?
Complete disconnect. It's hard to describe, Flo, and I thank you for that call, why that is. I think the bigger picture is that there's the sense of being interconnected here and interdependent is tough for people to take. But we really are. And if this crisis has shown us anything, it hopefully will show us that we all are in this together, this experiment called America and humanity. And, you know, you can't pit hedge funds versus manufacturing interests and expect America to be strong. Let's just put it that way. So let's just hope that all things work out the way we want them to and carry on, as they say, on the Nancy Skinner Show.